Welcome to Sideshow on 2RPH with Anthea Williams. Today I have Amy Claire Mills. Amy is an installation, textiles and performance artist based on Gadigal and Wangal land in Australia. Her work examines politics surrounding the female disabled body and deconstructs ableism. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So Amy, tell us, how did you become an artist?
A good question.
I know it's a tricky question to start, isn't it? But I love your work so much and I want to hear how it started.
I have a little bit of a journey, but I'll do the highlight reel. Basically, I did a photography degree in Canberra, the CIT, which is Canberra Institute of Technology. And after the photography degree, it was very design focused. And my uni lecturer, my lecturer in that degree said to me at the end, I don't think you should do photography. I think you should go to art school. I ended up doing a series of works during that degree that were very personal and looked at my journey with disability. One of them I took photographs of myself for 30 days. So I took 10 shots a day of all my medical regimes. So taking my tablets, going to doctors, going to blood tests, having x-rays, doing insulin on the fly at restaurants. I had pictures of like the needle going into my leg, and it was a very successful piece of work. And then, yeah, the uni lecturer, Sylvia, I love her to this day. She said I should go to art school. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I just finished this degree. Took a year off, moved to Sydney, did some really bad internships, and then was like, art school does look like fun. I had a friend at art school. They were studying at COPA, which is now UNSW Art & Design, and they looked like they were having the best time. So I decided to go to art school. So I applied, I got in, and then I ended up studying sculpture, performance and installation as my major. And I did a Bachelor of Fine Arts honours. And graduated in 2018, but finished in 2017, because you always graduate like the next year.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, and then after that, I still made art, which is very challenging. I remember, I always tell this story. I remember in second year, one of our uni lecturers, when I was studying fine art, said that after 5 years of art school, only 5% of people who come through the degree will still be practicing. So they kind of set us up for failure in second year, which I just think is a terrible kind of thing to set artists up for. It's already a very difficult pathway, and we should be saying, well, this is the reality, but this is all the things that we can do to combat it. We can work collectively. We can support each other. We can open up opportunities for marginalized communities. Like, I wish it was a statement of future intent rather than this is the reality, it sucks to be an artist. So I kind of worked really hard after uni, and it was a struggle, and it still is a struggle to this day. There's a lot of sacrifices that come with being an artist. So yeah, that's kind of how I became an artist.
But also, I bet so many of those people are still using their arts practice in their everyday lives, whether that's in their work life or in their creative life, if they've managed to merge those two things for money or not. You know, I think sometimes people are really reductive in what they think an artist is.
Exactly. And I mean, still to this day, I still have conversations. I've exhibited work across Australia. I've worked with really big institutions. I've worked with community groups. But I still have people being like, oh, do you make money off your art? And I think that's so reductive. Being an artist is a community endeavor, really. It's working collaboratively. It's representing your community. It, like, capitalist sort of structures, yeah, sure, we'd love to all get paid a living wage. I would love that. Mm. But being an artist is about creativity rather than, you know, it's not the end goal, it's the journey, really.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so naff.
No, like there's a reason why It is. You're right. You're absolutely right. It is a journey, and it's a long-term conversation you're having with yourself, with other artists, with institutions, and with your audience. And that evolves.
Yeah.
I guess that kind of segues nicely into my next question, which is, what is the conversation you are looking to have with your audience?
So I am a disabled woman. I use identity first language. I just want to clarify that. So I say disabled woman rather than artist with a disability. I've always wanted to tell stories that represent my community, that come from my kind of lived experience, but then broaden out and represent a whole lot of lived experiences. So it kind of always starts with me, my kind of projects or artworks, they always start with kind of an experience that I've had, but then they broaden out and I try to incorporate as many voices as I can into the conversation so that it properly represents my community, because I'd rather the collective story be told than the individual story. I think it's important that my artwork represents the community rather than just myself. My work talks about disability experience. It talks about ableism. It talks about kind of structures of power. It's feminist. Also talks, you know, it talks about queer theory. Like, there's lots of layers to my work.
I'd love you to describe a little bit of your work for the audience. Can you tell us a little bit about maybe unsolicited advice or burden of proof?
Yeah, unsolicited advice. Unsolicited advice was a quilt series that I did at First Draft Gallery in Woolloomooloo. And are they in Woolloomooloo? I think they're in Woolloomooloo. First Draft, anyways. And it kind of came from a conversation that I had with my friend about unsolicited advice. And I was like, oh, I want to make a big quilt that says, have you tried? And then I want like all the kind of answers from unsolicited advice that disabled people receive all around the gallery. And then it kind of, you know, I was like, well, I'm making a quilt, I should make cushions. So I ended up getting 45 responses. So I went out to my community and I asked about all the unsolicited advice that people had received. And I got such interesting replies. Some of the replies, I was like, oh, yeah, I've had that. So like, have you found Jesus? Yep, definitely had that. Have you tried praying? Have you tried drinking more water? Have you tried therapy? But then there were some weird ones in there. Like one of my friends got past life regression therapy. Have you tried past life regression therapy? And they are a transplant recipient. So I find that really funny, because organ donation is so strange and obscure and it's in our everyday life. But when you get down to Metairie, kind of like having someone else's organ inside you. I have had a transplant. I should disclose that. So the idea of having like past life regression therapy to like cure you, it just is so obscure, right? And then there was like one about colloidal silver. I had never even heard of this. So there was some really obscure things, but then there was some like real classic kind of responses. And I made 45 cushions and they had all the cures on them. And then there were other quilts in the series. So all up, I think there was 1, 2, 3, 4 quilts and then the 45 cushions on the wall. So it was very fun to make that series. I actually really liked it. And then that went on to like other series. All my work kind of relates. It kind of tumbles down a hill, right? So you start off with one idea and then like it opens Pandora's box to all these other ideas.
But I loved that exhibition so much because, of course, I've had lots of unsolicited advice as well. And looking at this giant wall of these beautiful cushions, because the textiles you work with are so extra, for want of a better word. You know, they're so brightly colored and the patterns and design is amazing and there's so much glitter and fabulousness. And that giant wall filled with all of these suggestions, and I had to say, none of them were a surprise. I was like, oh, yeah, I've had all of these. And over a lifetime, although actually I didn't read the one that said past life regression. That is a new one. I've never had that. But I've had the turmeric, the colloidal silver or whatever it's called. I've had the yoga. I've had that, you name it, I've had it. And it's so overwhelming when you look at it all and go, yes, it's all fluffy and soft and well-meaning, but it's too much. It's actually too much to deal with. And I think there's something amazing that goes on with your work, which is you present the voices that talk to the person with disability. You don't you allow us to have our own response back. Like, we're almost missing from the conversation. And by being missing in the conversation, we actually get to have the conversation. And I love that.
I always call my work like sickly sweet. So like you go in and you're so overwhelmed by the bright colors and the textures and the glitter and it's a party, but then you read the text and you're like kind of slapped over the face being like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be. This is actually quite serious. And now I have to confront my own kind of internalized ableism, like, have I ever participated in giving unsolicited advice? And lots of people came and saw that exhibition and related to it beyond the disability community. Lots of women came up to me afterwards and said, oh, as a mother, I receive unsolicited advice, or even, you know, going out and partying, girls being like, oh, you should wear this kind of dress to kind of, you know, not be attacked and stuff like that. So like, unsolicited advice isn't just to the disabled. It doesn't just speak to the disabled community. It actually is something that we all experience. But I think what I was trying to establish with the disability community and having that work was, when you receive this every single day, it becomes a microaggression and it ingrains in you this kind of, there's something wrong with me. How horrible that I always need to be thinking about fixing myself, and how isolating and lonely, and how much that separates you out from the community. So, yeah, unsolicited advice isn't just experienced by people in the disability community, but I would say it's experienced at such a high rate by people with disabilities.
I think you're absolutely right. And the assumption that if you have a chronic illness or a disability, you must be doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Which is simply not the case. I really love
And then people see the show and they're like, oh, okay, well, what if I do have really great advice and I want to give it? And I was like, you can always just ask consent. You can always just say, hey, I have this really great thing that might help. Do you want to hear about it or not? And then you're giving the person the capacity to say yay or nay. Maybe I do want to hear about it. Maybe I'm so desperate for anything that would help with this chronic pain or whatever I'm going through, but it should be on me whether I accept that advice or not. So I always just say, just ask consent. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. And also, how well do you know the person, and how well do they, you know, their history? You know, my primary diagnosis is rheumatoid arthritis. And that is, as soon as you say to someone, I have arthritis, most people think of their granny and her knuckles. They don't think of a two-year-old, you know, so there's so many different disease pathways. And, you know, they may have had a great time with turmeric, but they probably have a completely different disease pathway to me. So really, and also,
yeah,
over 43 years, do you really think I've never heard that turmeric might be useful?
Like, you know, don't find someone on the street and be like, oh, my cousin's sister's girlfriend has that disability as well and they tried this. Even within certain like disease community, I'm saying disease because I have cystic fibrosis and it's classified as a disease. Even within the cystic fibrosis community, it is so varied. People's experience, it can vary because of socioeconomic reasons. It can vary because of where you live, the climate that you live in. So it can vary because there's different gene types. So even if your sister's, brother's, cousin's girlfriend tried it and it was great for them, it actually may not work for me. And, you know, you telling me that, oh, this person had a great experience and they're alive and they're having the best time of their life because of turmeric, it might not work for me.
Exactly. I particularly loved your work, Burden of Proof, which I think was on at Carriage Works, which is two quilts facing each other, so the audience is in between them. And on one side, the quilt says, What's wrong with you? And on the other side, it says, have you ever thought it might all be in your head? And I just love that you're sandwiching an audience between those two questions. It's so provocative.
Yeah, they actually are very close. When they hung in the in Carriage Works, they were actually very close together. So, yeah, you really were sandwiched in between kind of the first part of the conversation. And again, like you said, Anthea, I am taking the disabled community's voice out of the conversation. So it's really this conversation that's happening without any reaction from us or any kind of pushback. It is just what people say to us. And this work was particularly poignant because I have ADHD and that comes into a lot of like being neurodiverse comes, you know, a lot of people like, oh, you know, it's just in your head, you know, you don't, or, and I have anxiety as well. And so like, it's almost like they just want to dismiss the experience as well and minimize it because they might feel uncomfortable by the experience. So yeah, that work was kind of, and it followed on very closely after Unsolicited Advice. It was on kind of at the same time as that work. So I had two works kind of having those conversations.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that you said your work was sickly sweet. Have you been working with textiles for long?
When I went through uni, as I said, I did SPI, so sculpture, performance and installation, and I came out of that doing a lot of performance work and I made costumes and kind of sets for my performance, and that really, I just fell in love with textiles through that process. I was part of a collective called Show Us Your Teeth with there was four of us, so three other amazing artists, and it was very textile-based, the works we made, and some of my collective members, Kate and Bailey and Monica, really taught me how to sew, and that was just, I just fell in love with textiles. I fell in love with, I think it's because I'm sensory-seeking, so I just fell in love with, like, being able to touch work and being able to interact with work in a different way than just visually was really appealing to me. And then the pandemic hit and I couldn't do performance work anymore because a lot of my performance work was at clubs and very interactive. So I couldn't do that anymore. And it brought me back to my love of textiles, but then quilting specifically, because when I was little, I grew up in hospitals. I spent from K through to year 12, collectively, I probably spent about 2 years in hospital. So when I was in hospital, I got given quilts by lovely volunteers and I had this beautiful book and they came around and they were like, what quilt do you want? And you got to like flick through the book and choose the book and then they would go and make the quilt for you. And so I still have to this day two beautiful quilts that I got, one when I had my transplant and one before that. So I still have those to this day and I love them and cherish them. And so the quilting kind of came out of that. I wanted to like honor that kind of experience. And it also came out of I spend a lot of time in bed.
Yes.
So lots of disabled people spend a lot of time in their bed. And I was like, I just want to make something comfy.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. I love that. And you work with a number of collectives. Can you tell us a little bit about how working with a collective changes your work and changes your processes?
Yeah, so I've worked with Show Us Your Teeth and New Moon Collective. I think I started working with Show Us Your Teeth in uni and it was, we set it up, me and another lovely artist named Shaz set it up because we wanted to skill share. So we were all like, okay, you're really good at woodwork, you're really good at painting, you're really good at drawing, you're really good at textiles. like, let's come together, make artworks together and share that kind of knowledge and skills sharing, which is so important, I think, in the artistic community. You know, you hone your skills in one area and then you think, oh, I'd love to expand, but it can be quite intimidating to expand. And then you can think, oh, gosh, I'm going to have to take a class and it's going to cost money. And so this is like a cost-effective way to do that, really. So I loved working with Show Us Your Teeth. It really set up the foundation of my arts practice. I cannot thank those beautiful, beautiful women enough for all they did for my practice. And then after uni, I started another collective called New Moon Collective with artists Roselle Flatley, Aletti Christou, and Kim Sue. And we had a art space in the Inner West Council for a couple of years where we'd hold like free or subsidized art classes. So we did scene making, I did stitch and bitch sessions. We partnered with other organizations as well, like Refugee Art Project, and did film nights. So again, I love being part of collectives. I adore it so much. I think there is being an artist is quite isolating. So there's that, it's like inbuilt community, but it's also just like learning from people who you may not have worked with and learning their stories and working with them and building community. So I love collectives. I think everyone should join a collective.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you tell us, what work do you have coming up?
So at the moment I have a work in Brisbane in Outer Space Gallery called, what is my show called? This Will Only Hurt for a Second. That's what it's called. And it's a series of soft sculptures of medical equipment. So I got one of those children's doctor's kits and I basically made them big. It's like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, but, you know, in reverse. Massive. So there's like an 8.6 meter stethoscope hanging in the gallery that you can go and cuddle. And that work is all about body autonomy and for disabled people having very invasive procedures and not having a good relationship with touch and intimacy because of these invasive procedures that we have to have throughout our life and how that kind of changes our relationships. So I wanted to make beautiful medical equipment that was cuddly and soft. And so you can go into the gallery. I made even like medical gloves that you can climb inside. They're sleeping bags and they've got velvet inside.
Oh, lovely.
So you can go and like get into a medical glove. And there's a little pillow so you can have a little sleep in the gallery. And then I have a series of workshops coming up at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in January for the Louise Bourgeois exhibition that's coming out. And I will be at the Art After Darks. So I'll be there for five of them in January. And we are making a beautiful giant beaded spider web. So you can come in. It's a drop-in workshop at the Art After Dark, and you can come and make little beaded spiders and be part of a bigger installation of a beaded spider web.
That sounds amazing. I will definitely drop in and make myself a beaded spider. And I need to find out from you when I can come to Stitch and Bitch, because I have a family of sewers and I have no skill and I need to redeem myself.
Well, that's so fun. Everyone is always like, oh, did you like sew from a kid? And I was like, nope, I learned at uni. So it's a skill that everyone can learn. I think it just seems intimidating because there's like really like artists, like really, like, you know, you look at couture gowns and you look at sewers on Instagram and they're like really good. And I'm like, oh, I patch things together.
Yeah. Hey, it has been so fantastic chatting to you today. I couldn't recommend your website more highly. I spent so much of my weekend on it and sent the link to so many of my Crip friends. So I'm going to put that in our show notes, and I really recommend that people have a look. It has been absolutely delightful chatting to you today. I just wish we had more time.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
You're on 2RPH with Sideshow. So, Hannah, what are you seeing and not seeing this month?
I'm looking forward to attending Movement Research New York's virtual screening of Krishna Washburn and Heather Shaw's film Telephone on November 15th, though this episode will be going to air after their screening date. So, for anyone who missed out, I've also been enjoying Siobhan Burke's recent New York Times article entitled Hear the Dance, Audio Description Comes of Age, discussing AD in dance, which is available in written format and visual format or as audio. The article highlights excerpts from the work Telephone as well as that of some other dance companies pioneering creative and disability-led AD. And for any listeners in Colorado, there'll be location-restricted streaming of Telephone from November 27th to December 17th. At the 20th anniversary festival season of Sans Souci Festival of Dance Cinema in Boulder, Colorado. Siobhan Burke's article can be found at nytimes.com, and tickets to Sans Souci are at sanssoucifestival.org. That's S-A-N-S-S-O-U-C-I festival.org.
Thanks, Hannah. What I'm really excited about, and I know you'll be able to access, is Eliza Hull's new album, Here They Come. I have to confess, I'm a massive Eliza Hull fan. In fact, one of her songs was my second most played song on my Spotify Unwrapped this year. But she is an amazing songwriter, advocate, and writer who I'm really hoping we're going to get on the show next year. She's going to be performing this new album across New South Wales and Victoria in dates through January and February. So there'll be lots of chances to see her live. But of course, you can listen to her album on Bandcamp and on Spotify, and we'll provide links to that. Hey, lovely chatting to you again, Hannah. As 2003 draws to a close, we're beginning our planning for 2024 and what's next for Sideshow. We'd love your feedback. If there's any particular artists or subjects you'd like us to discuss, please get in contact. You can email me at antheawilliamsnet@gmail.com. And now to take us out, Malaika Infame with Good Man.
Walking to the beat of an off drum, holding heels in my hands, I'm falling for the fall.